Argument this morning is Carr versus Riveros and State Farm.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Hastings, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Shelley Carr, in this case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes. You may proceed.
On March 18, 2013, Shelley went to a house as part of a home inspection to purchase the house. And while there, she was bit by a dog. And the dog that bit her was owned by the response in this case, Jose and Lisa Riveros. In what sounds like a very simple set of facts, of course, we have a twist here in what feels like a law school exam, because the complexities are that the Riveros rented the home that was being sold, and that my client was the mother of the prospective purchaser. We filed suit, and we brought two claims, one under common law and one under strict liability law. And the trial court, the Honorable Monica Benton, dismissed the case last summer. This appeal presents a couple of issues, but really the nut and the focus of it is whether there was consent for my client to be on this property.
Who do you claim gave consent?
The consent was through the agent of the owners of the property.
And that would be the agent of the owners. Did he know the mother-in-law was coming?
The agent, the consent, and see,
well,
and see, that's
answer my question. Did the agent of the owners know the mother-in-law was coming to the inspection?
There's nothing in the record stating that, Your Honor.
All right. Your position seems to be because the owner didn't exclude the mother-in-law, she had implied permission. When I left my house this morning, I didn't announce to anybody that they lacked permission to go in my front door. Did they all have permission?
No, Your Honor, but in this,
coming to clean the house. Can they bring anybody they want through my house because I've given the cleaner permission?
Not unless it's within the custom, Your Honor.
Okay, what's your evidence of the custom of the industry?
The evidence of the custom of the industry is the home inspector, Mr. Lind, had testified that he had 50% of his clients bringing family members.
And that's evidence of a custom-wide practice, an industry-wide custom?
I would think so, Your Honor, for purposes of summary judgment. I don't think that this rises to the level of where I need to provide expert testimony, like as in a medical malpractice case, where we're dealing with something that's beyond the reasonable comprehension. These are individuals, both Lind and also the...
Well, there's some cases that say that evidence that one person does something a particular way isn't evidence of custom in an industry. How would you distinguish them?
I would think that an individual who is presenting evidence of custom in that field, and based on their qualifications and how many inspections that they do, that gives rise to an issue of fact. I think that anything else would go to weight.
Shouldn't we at least require that they say, I am familiar with what other folks do and they do the same thing?
I believe that the real estate agent, Mr. Shim, did do that, Your Honor.
The real estate agent or the inspector?
I believe that both of them did. So just real quick back to, you know, the other interesting issue that this case brings up is whether we have an overlay of the premise liability duty that's circumscribed in the restatements discussing licensees and invitees. It's my position that that duty doesn't apply because we have a duty under an independent duty under common law that arises under Section 518. And that provides that we can bring a cause of action even if we don't know the dangerous propensities of a dog if there is evidence of negligence. And in this case, I would submit that we did present evidence that created an issue of fact as to whether there was, in fact, negligence on behalf of the Riveros.
What do you claim the Riveros should have done that they didn't do?
Well, they should have removed the dog. They knew that there was going to be an inspection. They knew through the agent who represented the seller of the home that complete access to the home needed to be given. They knew that
they have an obligation under their lease to agree to all of that that you've described.
Well, whether they disagree with the nature of what the inspection would have entailed, that would have been an issue between the renters and the owners, and they didn't bring a counterclaim or any claim.
The fact that they didn't respond to the demand that they crate their dog.
Well, that they didn't, I believe, is evidence of negligence. This was a reasonable.
Well, do I have, when I go into somebody's house after being told that I've got a sick dog in a room with the door shut, please don't disturb it, do I have the right to go into that room?
Yeah, you do. And that would be weighed.
What's the legal authority for that?
Well, that would be weighed under relative.
No, what's the legal authority for? I've already told you, don't go in the room. My sick dog's in there. What's the legal authority for entering the room?
Well, in this case, there's no evidence that was conveyed to my clients. So
clients knew the dog was in the room.
Correct.
And they didn't shut the door when they left. That's what your client testified to. The dog got out of the room because they went in safely. The dog didn't bother them. They went out. The dog then got out into the area outside the door. Your client then went to pick up a dog that she knew was sick and older and tried to move it. Pretty big dog. And the reason that was necessary is because she forgot to shut the door. The inspector did. We don't know which one of them. And when the dog growled, she then went and got down and the face of the dog with her face and hand, and that's how it got bit. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I would say that's a pretty fair representation. My response to that.
Go ahead.
My response to that, real briefly, Your Honor, would just be that those are all facts that the jury would be considering and whether they're assigning any comparative fault to my client. So I believe that the duty is circumscribed under 518. I don't think that premise liability needs to apply. She certainly wasn't a trespasser because there was implied consent for her to be there by both the Riveros as well as the owners of the house. And then there's also the issue of strict liability.
Can the owners consent when there's a tenant?
Pardon?
Can the owners consent when there's a tenant and the person who claims to receive the consent knows there's a tenant?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the contract and also landlord-tenant law.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is also Shelley McGoy, obviously not Shelley Carr. I intend to address three things, obviously Section 518 for common law, strict liability, the dog bite statute, 16.08040, and then the abuse of discretion issue. But I think in response to Judge Leach's question, I'm going to just jump in on the idea of the consent issue.
Okay, because could you comment on the question of fact about custom in the industry?
Absolutely. I'll go there first then. Mr. Lindy was the inspector, and he was deposed. And he offered a personal opinion about approximately 50% of his clients, if you were bring family members. He was never addressed or set forth as an expert. He never laid the foundation that this extrapolates to anybody in the industry. He said it was his personal opinion and his own.
Counsel has said that both he and the selling realtor said that it was a custom in the industry to bring family members. Do you disagree with that?
I disagree with that to the extent that Shem, who was the selling agent, did not testify to that at deposition, and only after the motion for summary judgment was lost and the plaintiff submitted a motion for reconsideration did they attach a declaration from Mr. Shim that
okay, at the original summary judgment hearing, was there testimony from any witness that purported to describe the custom in the industry in contrast to one individual's practice?
No. Other than the vague reference to Lindy, there was no evidence offered to that. So that was absolutely not part of the record for purposes of summary judgment. But it was, as indicated.
I understand there was a motion for reconsideration with some new evidence presented.
Right. So as it goes back to Section Section 518 for common law, or maybe I'm going to jump to strict liability for a second. So obviously, because it's strict liability, it's in derogation of common law, it's strictly construed. And the argument was whether or not Ms. Carr was lawfully on the premises. And I've quite frankly argued that first in my motion for summary judgment because I thought that was the easiest part. Because I did, if you reviewed the transcript from the motion for summary judgment, I said, you know, it's always more difficult on a common law negligence claim to deal with the various issues that reasonable minds cannot differ. So I started with the strict liability argument before Judge Benton, and Judge Benton took it under advisement, all of the facts as it related to the various arguments on foreseeability. And as the court knows, this summary judgment can be upheld on a variety of reasons, not just my foreseeability argument. But I don't have the benefit of knowing exactly what Judge Benton's rationale was, and obviously this is de novo. It's for the three of you to decide. And it dawned on me that as far as the common law argument goes and the reasonable mind standard, there's a variety of ways that Judge Benton easily got to the result that she did. The foreseeability argument, a superseding intervening cause, even the whole idea that there was no duty to begin with, because the whole argument in the motion for summary judgment, or actually in response to the motion for summary judgment, was that the duty under the common law was a duty to crate, and that was absolutely and is absolutely not the duty. The duty is to prevent harm commensurate with the character of the animal. And in this case, as Judge Leach very succinctly pointed out, this was a sickly, dying dog that was confined in a laundry room closed by a door. And while it may seem like a stretch to argue that the dog was fenced, the dog was clearly sequestered. And these people, at least not Ms. Carr, but her daughter and son-in-law had been there before and knew not to go into the laundry room.
Is there any duty in this fact pattern to respond to the email that said there's been a request to crate, and their agent, the tenant's agent, says back to the other agent, well, I don't know what they're going to do. I'm not sure what their plan is. Is there a duty to for the tenants then to say something and respond to that proposal?
I don't think there is, Your Honor. And let me highlight the surrounding facts and the emails in regards to that. Nobody picked up the phone and called the tenant in this case. They sent text messages and confirmed the night before March 18th that there had been no confirmation that the dog would be crated. The only communication, and it's in the record at clerk's papers starting at 303 through 305, is that Mr. Riveras responded that he got the message. He never confirmed that he was going to crate it. The only thing he did is he asked initially in these communications is, I go to work at 8:30. Can you come at 8? And the response was no from the purchasing agent, or excuse me, the selling agent, Mr. Hogan. So I think that the duty really doesn't fall on Mr. and Mrs. Riveras. I think that the duty to, as I said, in common law, to prevent the harm commensurate with the character is the duty, but to respond or to take time off work without special arrangements being made, and then to not only do that, but extrapolate it down the line that this would inure to the benefit of somebody they don't even know will be coming to their house. So I think the court might have reached a different result, or it might have been somewhat construed differently. If the dog had been roaming in the house and not been confined and limited to the laundry room, and the person that they anticipated would be there, because I think if there is any kind of expectation of custom or allowance to come in, there were three people that would be impliedly allowed to have come into that house that day. Nobody was impliedly allowed to come into the laundry room. But clearly, three people and three people only. The inspector, who was smart enough to say, we're not going in that laundry room. I'm not even going in the house. Get these people on the phone. A text message was sent at 9:30 a.m. from Hogan to the, from Mr. Shim to the Hogan listing agent, say, get a hold of Mr. Riveras. Did they do anything? No, they ignored it. Instead, they went into the house, conducted the inspection, and at the end of the inspection, decided to go into the laundry room.
So, what would be the result if they opened the laundry room door and the dog attacked the person as the door was being opened?
That, I think, is an excellent question. I definitely think the result would be different if the two people that they knew that was going to be there and the inspector walked into the front door and that happened. I think it would be a different case.
I don't want the dog roaming the house. That's a much different case. But let's say the inspector opens the laundry room door and is attacked by the dog as he does so. Is there strict liability?
No.
Why not?
There is not strict liability because they did not have implied permission to go into the laundry room.
Okay.
So was there implied permission to go into the house? Yes. But I see that no different than, crate. We all know in lay terms what a crate is. But to these people, to Mr. and Mrs. Riveras, because this is where they had put the dog before, they in essence restricted and crated it in the laundry room. So if you had permission, you never had, no one ever had permission to go into the laundry room. In fact, when this sales transaction started, because this, as counsel pointed out, is a, tenant, the homeowner wants to sell, the communication, and it starts at clerk's papers 299, communication is started with Miss Mary Joyce with the tenant. Make arrangements. Please work with Mr. Hogan. He's going to be communicating with you.
Is there any question of fact raised in the record about whether it was the landlord or the tenant who had authority to consent to entry into the laundry room?
I'm sorry, is the question, was there anything in the record that
to
the landlord?
The landlord rather than the tenant could consent to entry into the laundry room.
Well, there was plenty of evidence that I think you're talking about the homeowner. The landlord. The landlord wasn't.
Yeah, I don't care about plenty of evidence. I want to know if there's any evidence from which a trier of fact could conclude that the landlord had authority to consent to entry into the laundry room.
Absolutely not. This was the communication between Mary Joyce, who started the communication, and Mr. Hogan, who was the agent of the landlord. Communicated with Mr. Hogan. The listing agreement is in the record, and they came and took pictures, and they specifically went over the information that under no circumstances do not bother the dog. The dog was placed, as I said, in the laundry room, and when other people viewed the house, they didn't disobey that. So the landlord, I think that my brief touches upon that, Your Honor, too, that the tenant had the exclusive quiet, right, and enjoyment of use of the property. So to the extent you're inconveniencing them in their kind of lease and home and security of their home, you need to accommodate them. And the landlord had no authority to consent to somebody. And I would mention, I have 2 seconds left, that they never consented under any circumstances to somebody they didn't even know.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to touch briefly on the evidence with regard to custom. This was on reconsideration, but Mr. Shim did testify that
I'm mostly interested in evidence that was presented to the court when the original motion was heard, because we have a defendant.
Shim was not on that, right. But Shim was not presented.
What evidence was there in the context of the original motion about custom beyond Mr. Linton's testimony about his own individual practice?
That would be Mr. Lind, Your Honor.
Lind.
Correct. But I would like to point out that we moved under CR 59 for reconsideration. We weren't given a hearing. There was no request for additional briefing. We have no idea what the judge, the Honorable Monica Benton, did, whether there were no findings made as to whether this was new evidence that couldn't be discovered before. There was no hearing on that. And I also point out that we did move under.
I recall the local rule, the other party doesn't respond to a motion for reconsideration unless the court asks for a response. Is that the situation still?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So she got your motion and then made a ruling that it was being denied, and that's all we know about the process.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so I would submit that the court cannot adequately analyze the issues with regard to whether this was new evidence that was improperly before the court. And I just would also like to point out that we moved under multiple sections of CR 59, including that there was an error of law. So Shim clearly does testify as to the real estate industry and the practice within that industry, and that would be in his declaration. I also want to touch briefly on the door closing, because the argument is essentially, well, this door was closed, and therefore a reasonable person shouldn't have gone in. And I understand that argument, but the problem is that there's not something more here. And I think that if there was something more, right, like a sign on the door saying, do not go in here, there's a document.
Was there a question that the people knew that the Riveros didn't want people going in there?
There's questions.
Express that?
There's questions of fact with regard to that, Your Honor, because that was communicated. The seller's agent last communication, written communication to the renters, was that complete access is required, and that I suggest creating the dock. There was nothing back saying.
Okay, well, that would suggest an absence of consent. I mean, you don't create consent by telling someone you need it. You have to hear it from the person who has the power to give it, and nobody heard from those people.
Well, I would also argue, Your Honor, that I think this is clear in my briefing, is that the initial threshold layer here is that the owners are the ones who are giving consent. They are, for the purposes of their business, selling the house.
How can they give consent to enter when the landlord doesn't have the right to possession?
I would submit that the landlord did have right to possession and that there was no objection to that possession, and that would be a dispute.
What in the record establishes the landlord's right to possession?
That would be the lease agreement between the tenants and the owner of the property, as well as landlord-tenant law, that they're allowed to make periodic inspections and that this was part of
the Landlord-Tenant Act has specific notice requirements for non-emergency entry.
Right.
There's no evidence in the record that any of those notices were given.
But these are all issues that the Riveros can make with regard to the sellers and for indemnification.
To first have a right to enter, you have to have given the notice in a timely fashion as required by the statute, and there's no evidence that occurred.
But that issue is not before the court because it was never raised by the Riveros, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The final